Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, June 24th, 2021. Here are some of your headlines. President Joe Biden declares we have a deal on infrastructure spending. After meeting with a bipartisan group of senators at the White House, the total of that deal, almost $1 trillion, with $579 billion in new spending. But President Biden also says he will not sign that compromise into law without a second bill with more spending expected to be passed under a budget procedure that needs only Democratic support. We'll have details coming up in just a moment. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announcing the creation of a special congressional committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. This after an attempt to create an independent commission through law was blocked by Senate Republicans. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention extending for 1 month the coronavirus pandemic eviction moratorium that was set to expire June 30th, new deadline July 31st. It gives more time to disperse $46 billion in emergency federal rental assistance approved by Congress. Census Bureau says more than 6 million renters are still behind on their rent. And some yelling erupts at a House hearing over whether to mandate paid family and medical leave for all workers. From the Wall Street Journal, President Biden and a group of centrist senators agreeing to a roughly $1 trillion of infrastructure spending, securing a long-sought bipartisan deal on overhauling the nation's transportation, water, and broadband infrastructure that lawmakers in the White House will now attempt to shepherd through a closely divided Capitol Hill. President Biden speaking at the White House after meeting with that bipartisan group.
I said many times before, there's nothing our nation can't do when we decide to do it together, do it as one nation. Today is the latest example of that truth in my view. I'm pleased to report that a bipartisan group of senators, five Democrats, five Republicans, part of a larger group, have come together and forged an agreement that will create millions of American jobs and modernize our American infrastructure to compete with the rest of the world known in the 21st century. I want to thank them for working together and for raising their ideas and concerns with me and with the Vice President, as well as with our jobs cabinet. Secretary Buttigieg is here. Good to see you, Mr. Secretary. Secretary Fudge, Secretary Granholm, Secretary Fudge. There you are. Okay, you guys got to make sure. I thought everybody was on this side. Secretary Mondo and Secretary Walsh. I also want to thank Senator Shelley Caputo for earlier work on infrastructure agreement. We didn't reach an agreement, but she tried her best to get something done. I'm sure it helped produce the final agreement we had. The fact is, investment in jobs and infrastructure have often had bipartisan support in the past. Matter of fact, when I first got to the United States Senate, it was probably the least difficult thing to do, is pass infrastructure plans. But even so, it's been a very long time since the last time our country was able to strike a major bipartisan deal on American infrastructure, which is so badly needed, I might add. We've devoted far too much energy to competing with one another and not nearly enough energy competing with the rest of the world to win the 21st century.
President Biden at the White House. CNN reports that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi made clear on Thursday that the U.S. House will not take up the bipartisan infrastructure bill until the Senate passes a larger, more sweeping infrastructure package through budget reconciliation. That would need only a simple majority to pass the Senate, and that could be done if all the Democrats vote yes, assuming all the Republicans vote no. President Biden asked about that second bill.
Mr. President, what assurances do you have at this point that you have sufficient Democratic support both in the Senate and the House to move both on this bipartisan deal and on the reconciliation package?
You always ask me those things. Nobody knows for certain. It's your job, but you know it's not a reasonable question. And the reason I say that, I may be critical. The idea of my telling you now that I know what every senator, how they're going to vote, is just not, I don't know that. I do know that among the roughly 20 bipartisan groups of senators and senators that I met with, well, only 10 were here today, but that group, that we had an agreement. For example, they talk about, well, why would Biden compromise? Well, when's the last time, if you had asked me whether or not I'd be able to get passenger rail service for $66 billion worth, largest investment ever since Amtrak came about? I asked for 90, got $66 billion. Talk about public transit. $49 billion. $49 billion of public transit. When I raised that before, somebody looked at me like, where have you been, Biden? You've been spending too much in China or something. I hadn't been to China. You know, electric buses, $7.5 billion. I asked for 15. I couldn't get all of it. We compromised. Electric infrastructure, that is charging stations along the roads. I asked for 15. I got 7.5. These are significant down payments on things that we finally got after skillful negotiation on the part of my cabinet and my team, led by Mr. Ricchetti. And so when you ask me, what guarantee do I have that I have all the votes I need, I don't have any guarantee. But what I do have is a pretty good read over the years of how the Congress and the Senate works. And the idea that we're not going, because someone's not going to be able to get every single thing they want, they're going to vote against some of the things I just named, with nothing in here that's, quote, bad for the environment, bad for the economy, bad for the transportation, is unlikely. But I can't guarantee it.
President Joe Biden at the White House. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a prominent progressive in the House, criticized the lack of diversity among the 10 Senate negotiators on this infrastructure bill. All of those negotiators are white. The congresswoman tweeting, the diversity of this bipartisan coalition, in quotes, pretty perfectly conveys which communities get centered and which get left behind when leaders prioritize bipartisan deal-making over inclusive lawmaking, which prioritizes delivering the most impact possible for the most people. That tweet from Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. After President Biden's meeting with the bipartisan group, they all came out to speak with reporters outside the White House, President Biden joining them as well. And the group's leaders also spoke. Republican Rob Portman of Ohio, Democrat Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona.
Listen, I appreciate the fact that the president came out today to express what we all believe, which is we didn't get everything we wanted, but we came up with a good compromise that's going to help the American people. This is about infrastructure. Every president over the past four or five presidents has talked about doing a big infrastructure package. You may recall that President Trump proposed a $2 trillion infrastructure package. Today we are announcing the framework for an historic investment in infrastructure. This is roads and bridges, but also lots of other kinds of infrastructure, including broadband, including our water system and our rail system, all of which is good for the economy. This will lead to more efficiency in our economy, higher productivity, more economic growth. This is about the long term. And it's something that traditionally has been very bipartisan. And I'm pleased to see today we were able to come together on a core infrastructure package. This is not non-infrastructure items, without new taxes, and with the commitment from Republicans and Democrats alike that we're going to get this across the finish line. So I appreciate my colleagues behind me. This was a team effort. Everybody was equally involved. Kyrsten Sinema did a great job leading the effort, and I want to now ask courtesy a few words.
Thank you, Rob. You know, there are many who say that bipartisanship is dead in Washington, D.C. and across this country, but this historic agreement today between Republicans and Democrats in the Senate and with the President of the United States shows that when a group of people who are committed with shared values to solving the problems and challenges our country faces, we can use bipartisanship to solve these challenges. As Rob said, and as the President said, no one got everything they wanted in this package. We all gave some to get some, because what we did was put first the needs of our country. This does represent a historic investment in our country's infrastructure, and it meets the needs of folks who live from Virginia out to Arizona. It invests in green energy and climate, recognizing the changing nature of our country and our future. It invests in broadband and our power grid and our structures. And we are delighted to go back to the Hill and begin earning more support from both Republicans and Democrats to get this bill across the finish line.
Senators Kyrsten Sinema and Rob Portman outside the White House, surrounded by others in that bipartisan group of senators. With more on the infrastructure spending deal, we're joined by Washington Post White House reporter Tyler Pager. Thanks for being with us. President Biden really put himself out there today applauding this almost $1 trillion compromise. But the question is, will it pass the House and Senate? What's been the reaction so far?
Yeah, this was really a victory lap for President Biden. He has been adamant that he could get a bipartisan deal with the senators on something for infrastructure And so far, it seems like that is what they agreed to at the White House today when he met with that group of 10 senators and then held an event in the White House to celebrate, you know, this agreement. But an agreement on the top line numbers is very different from legislation passing the Senate and the House and then being signed into law. And I think that legislative process combined trying to keep everyone in line to get it over the to get it to the president's desk is one that's going to be quite complicated.
And also there's this dual track that the president mentioned. Another bill he's expecting through the budget reconciliation process passed only by Democrats. And he said he won't just sign one. He needs to sign both. So what's going to be in that second bill?
Right. And so that is the one of the biggest hurdles that faces, you know, that the Democrats face in trying to get both these bills over the line. That second reconciliation bill is going to be focused on the human infrastructure. So caregiving, child tax credits, housing, things that Republicans do not see as quote unquote infrastructure that Democrats have sought to expand the definition of and include into this wide ranging package. But, you know, one of the challenges here is that progressive Democrats and even House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she will not pass that bipartisan deal unless the Senate also passes at the same time the reconciliation bill. So we're going to see whether or not they can keep everyone in line in the Senate to get those passed and sent over to the House, which would, you know, allay concerns from progressives that by just passing a bipartisan deal, they're shirking the responsibility, the, you know, what they see as the responsibility of the Democrats to pass both.
During the negotiations, there was a lot of disagreement between the White House and the Senate Republicans over the pay-fors, how to get the money. Does the compromise mention anything about that?
Yeah, so one of the big areas of concern there was over a gas tax. Republicans wanted to index the gas tax to inflation. They also wanted taxes around electric vehicles. For Biden, that was a red line. He had made very clear in his campaign that he would not raise taxes on anyone making less than $400,000 a year, and the White House viewed those user fees as violating that pledge. Ultimately, the Democrats won out on that issue, and the gas tax nor the EV taxes in this this framework that they agreed upon. The pay-fors are largely about more tax enforcement as well as using unused funds from the stimulus package passed earlier in the year.
We're talking with Tyler Pager from The Washington Post. It's sort of understandable why President Biden wanted this compromise. Why did the Republicans agree to this, knowing that they might be voting against part two?
Yeah, I mean, infrastructure has historically been a bipartisan issue. Roads, bridges, tunnels, just the way in which Americans get around is something that has long been something that Republicans and Democrats agreed needed investing. But I think one of the things that Republicans realize is, you know, Democrats likely had the vote to pass it on their own anyway. And so by negotiating, they were able to get some of the stuff that they wanted or keep some of the stuff that they wanted out. Reconciliation is a path forward that Democrats have to avail themselves to because they have 50 votes in the Senate, and that's all you need to pass a budget resolution. And so for Republicans, I think, you know, the more moderate Republicans that are engaged in this process felt they really had the opportunity to influence legislation in a way they wouldn't when it would just be passed on a straight party line vote.
And finally, these negotiations have been going on for weeks. You wrote a really interesting article about a key figure on the White House side, the headline at the Post calling him the Biden whisperer, Steve Ricchetti. What did you find?
Yeah, so Steve Ricchetti was chief of staff to one of his chiefs of staff as to Biden when he was vice president, now counselor to the president, and took the lead on infrastructure negotiations. And we kind of, you know, wrote this profile of him as this behind-the-scenes figure that was playing a huge role in the shaping of this package. And we looked at his career in Washington, someone who has been ideologically flexible, working on multiple sides of an issue, and someone who really represents Biden's extroverted side, someone who's very good at making relationships, investing in relationships. People saying they are all, you know, he's always on the phone. They are more likely to remember where they met him for dinner than what his position was on a specific policy issue. And he's really that person that takes Biden's approach of politics is personal to the extreme and really is able to invest in relationships and work toward compromise in that way. And I think that's what we saw with this agreement that they touted today.
Washington Post White House reporter Tyler Pager. Read the stories at WashingtonPost.com. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
While spending to address climate change still a major priority of infrastructure spending for President Biden, not so much for the Republicans in Congress. Today, the Senate overwhelmingly passed a bill sort of dealing with that. It would help farmers access voluntary markets to sell carbon credits. Final vote in the Senate was 92-8. The Growing Climate Solutions Act now goes to the House for consideration. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 322, NASDAQ up 97, S&P up 24. Commerce Department says the U.S. economy grew at a yearly pace in the first quarter of 2021 of 6.4%. That's in line with economists' expectations as the country comes out of the COVID-19 pandemic. And the Federal Reserve releasing the results of the annual bank stress test, saying all 23 institutions examined would remain well above minimum required capital levels during a hypothetical economic downturn. Reuters reports that the stress test results means large banks will no longer face pandemic-era restrictions on how much they can spend buying back stock and paying dividends. This is Washington Today. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announcing the House will establish a select committee to investigate the attack on the U.S. Capitol January 6th. At her weekly press conference, she said she wished the Democrats and Republicans had come together to agree to a bipartisan independent commission to look at events from that day, but this was the only way it could be done.
However, this morning, with great solemnity and sadness, I'm announcing that the House will be establishing a select committee on the January 6th insurrection. Again, January 6th was one of the darkest days in our nation's history. I've said it now three times. It is imperative that we establish the truth of that day and ensure that an attack of that kind cannot happen and that we root out the causes of it all. The Select Committee will investigate and report on the facts and the causes of the attack, and it will make report recommendations for the prevention of any future attack. Just to remind all of you, 9/11, people keep referencing the 9/11 Commission, and 9/11 was signed into law by the President of the United States on November 27th, 2002, 14 and a half months after 9/11. In the meantime, Congress had a bipartisan committee investigate 9/11. I served as co-chair of that as a ranking Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, so I know it full well. And it provided great information that was useful to the 9/11 Commission once it came into being. So we see this as complementary, not instead of, and hopeful that there could be a commission at some point. As I said on the House floor, when we passed the legislation on the commission, the Capitol of the United States has always been a glorious beacon of democracy for the American people and the world. I say it again, the Select Committee is about our democracy and about ensuring that the Capitol Dome remain a symbol of freedom, about preserving America's role as an emblem of resilience, determination, and hope. That is our purpose. That is what the Select Committee will be about, and that is about seeking and finding the truth.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The bill that would have created a January 6th commission passed the House last month with 35 Republicans supporting it, but it was blocked in the Senate. Only a few Republicans there voting yes ended up being six short of the required 60 overall aye votes to advance the bill. This from Politico about this select committee, saying that it would allow Democrats to combine existing investigations, but risks being perceived as partisan. Democrats heavily criticized Republican select committee to investigate the 2012 attacks in the Libyan city of Benghazi, for example. Also, Speaker Pelosi did not announce today who will lead the commission. She said she'll make that announcement later. And today, the New York Supreme Court suspending the law license of Rudy Giuliani, saying that Giuliani made demonstrably false and misleading statements to courts, lawmakers, and the public when he represented former President Trump and his campaign in their failed effort to overturn the 2020 election results. Former President Donald Trump putting out a statement that reads in part, "The greatest mayor in the history of New York City, the Elliot Ness of his generation, one of the greatest crime fighters our country has ever known, and this is what the radical left does to him." He goes on, "Can you believe that New York wants to strip Rudy Giuliani, a great American patriot, of his law license because he has been fighting what has already been proven to be a fraudulent election, part of the statement from former President Donald Trump. One day after President Biden outlined an anti-crime strategy, which includes cracking down on illegal gun sales, the Senate Judiciary Committee today voting not to advance the president's nominee for director of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, known as ATF. The vote in the committee was 11-11, and ties fail. Some of the debate before the vote, Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein.
I believe that David Shipman is not only qualified, but he's a person that we need in this position at this time. He's the leader that ATF needs, and I want to just share with you that I am very concerned about where this country is going with violence and guns. We are currently experiencing a wave of gun violence. So far, 21,000 people in the United States have died, lost their lives through gun violence. In fact, during Mr. Chipman's own nomination hearing, and while I was speaking, a gunman in San Jose, California, shot and killed 9 innocent people. So there are staccato shots of guns that, like I've never heard, in the numbers that are building up. Mr. Chipman's support for the enforcement of common sense gun restrictions, his dedication to ensuring that the ATF fulfills its mission of protecting our country, make him the candidate we need in this role at this time. I think he's uniquely qualified to lead the ATF. He's a former ATF agent. He knows what it's like on the streets. And I learned, in a long time as mayor, that the streets teach you a lot about what people are doing and thinking.
Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat from California. Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah opposed this nomination.
In response to questions at his confirmation hearing before this committee, Mr. Chipman said he was a cop, not a lawyer. This statement is troubling, not only because Mr. Chipman was using it to dodge legitimate questions, but also because in making it, he willfully ignores that the focus of the ATF director's position is to accurately interpret and apply the laws Congress writes for the regulation of the firearms industry. I'm not saying that it takes a lawyer to do that, but it certainly takes someone who recognizes the impact of regulatory decisions. I'm concerned that Mr. Chipman used that cute line to persuade us that his advocacy background is less troubling than it might otherwise appear to be. Based on Mr. Chipman's bombastic and often inaccurate statements made while working as a lobbyist for two major anti-gun groups, Giffords and Everytown, I have strong concerns about his ability to set aside his personal views to work with the firearms industry and with law-abiding gun owners to effectively run ATF. For example, just last year, Mr. Chipman made a statement openly mocking first-time gun owners. He compared them to the Tiger King, a popular reality TV star who exhibited questionable judgment in relation to firearms and also large endangered megafauna. He also then advised them to hide their newly purchased firearms behind the cans of tuna and beef jerky they have stored in a cabinet and only bring them out if the zombies start to appear. That's a direct quote.
Senator Mike Lee during today's Judiciary Committee meeting. Again, the vote on the David Chipman nomination was a tie, 11-11, so it was not reported to the full Senate. However, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is allowed to make a motion to discharge the nomination from committee for a full Senate vote. Washington Today continues in a minute. And welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. President Biden saying the federal government is ready to help after that condo building collapsed north of Miami Beach, Florida, leaving at least one person dead and about 100 unaccounted for. The president said that FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is assessing the situation on the ground, but it cannot provide help until Florida Governor Ron DeSantis declares a state of emergency. A Russian senior diplomat says his country prepared to target intruding warships if they do not heed warnings. This comes after Russia on Wednesday fired warning shots and a warplane dropped bombs in the path of a British destroyer in the Black Sea near the Crimean city of Sevastopol. Great Britain says its ship was not fired upon and that it was sailing in Ukrainian waters. And the final edition of Hong Kong's last remaining pro-democracy newspaper sold out in hours, all 1 million copies of the Apple Daily. Paper says it was forced to end operations after Chinese police froze its assets, searched its office, and arrested five top editors and executives, accusing them of foreign collusion to endanger national security. The issue of how U.S. schools should teach about racism has again come up in a congressional hearing. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona testifying before the House Education and Labor Committee. Questions from Congressman Glenn Grothman, Republican from Wisconsin.
You issued proposed priorities for American history and civics education classes. Within these priorities, you approvingly quoted the professor Ibram X. Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. He argued for what he calls an anti-racist amendment to the U.S. Constitution. He says that, among other things, the amendment should establish a Department of Anti-Racism to monitor public officials for expressions of racist ideas. I mean, today it seems like everybody's racist. Monitor public officials. His proposed amendment would require the Department of Anti-Racism to pre-clear all local, state, and federal policies. Mr. Secretary, do you think this is kind of a radical proposal or kind of inconsistent with where we should be going?
I want to comment that for me, it's really important that I reiterate at every opportunity I have that the federal government doesn't get involved in curriculum. And I think it doesn't prescribe, nor does it mandate, does it regulate curriculum. That's left to the states and the locals. And I think, you know, quite frankly, it's probably more political than it is a program. So I want to make sure that I make that clear every chance I have.
It kind of concerns me a little that you quote this guy. Do you, you know, I just read a little bit about what he's got in there. Do you understand that's radical and outside the mainstream or should be outside the mainstream?
Again, the focus for us is really giving districts and states the opportunity to select and to think about educating. And I'll be very frank with you. You're an educator, right? I trust educators across the country to make decisions on what their communities need. And we have local boards for that reason. And we have state officials for that reason. It's really not the federal government's role to determine what gets taught.
Education Secretary Miguel Cardona and Republican Congressman Glenn Grothman at today's hearing. A headline at Time.com reads, "Critical race theory is simply the latest boogeyman inside the fight over what kids learn about American history." And joining us now is the author, staff writer at Time, Olivia Waxman. Thanks so much for being with us. Part of that headline is a quote from a professor. Who said it, and what does that mean, simply the latest boogeyman?
Sure. So there's a long history of controversies about what's taught in schools. It's part of, you know, much longer culture wars in America. And, you know, the historians I talked to said that, you know, usually during times of a lot of unrest and uncertainty, you will start to hear concerns about how history is taught in schools, or people just to saying in general, there must be a problem with what's happening in schools. Let's take a look. You know, how are our kids being taught their history? And so what that critical race theory scholar is getting at, Sumi Cho, is just that this critical race theory, this word that's become such a buzzword, is just part of a, you know, decades-long agenda. She was arguing on the right that, you know, conservative think tanks have, you know, often, you know, in these culture wars have had a lot to, they have other sort of policies that they're looking into about, you know, public education. They've tied in, these conversations have tied into conversations about vouchers or charter schools, school choice, and those kinds of issues. And that critical race theory is simply the latest.
There's another line from your article that it's our understanding of the past, a key factor on how we envision our future. You write, this is a story about the story and the myths America tells about itself. Can you explain that a little more?
Yes, definitely. So one of the reasons that this discussion, I think, has gotten so heated is because how we talk about the past says a lot about how we see ourselves. And actually, one of the great things in these conversations was that, you know, parents would talk on both sides, talk about how much they love America and talk about, you know, all their family members that, you know, make America great. And, you know, I think there's a lot of conversation now just to make sure that we're including the perspectives of all the Americans throughout history who have contributed to America.
Video of parents fighting at school board meetings are being posted online almost daily. This seems to be ramping up quickly across the country. And meanwhile, President Biden talks about how much Americans have in common. There is more that unites us than separates this. How does this culture war end, or at least reaches a ceasefire?
That's a really good question. And you're exactly right. These school board meetings, I think some people have pointed out there's probably more attention than ever before nationally on so many school board meetings at once, because a lot of these conversations are taking place there. Education is local. Curriculum's made locally. So school board candidates are being asked to, where do they stand on critical race theory? Where do they stand on the 1619 Project? So I think to answer your question of where this goes from here, I think we're still finding out. I think there's going to be a lot of movement on both sides playing out over the summer. You know, one of the things you hear from educators is that, yeah, students might be out for the summer, they get summer vacation, but educators are working really hard in the summers to prepare for next year. And so I think a lot of these conversations are happening now because of get ready for back to school. So, you know, I think we're going to see how a lot of this plays out when people get back to school. And then, you know, also the question of sort of the political issues. You know, some political candidates have come out and said they, you know, will support, 1776 pledge or, you know, patriotic education. And so I think we'll just see how that plays out, you know, how this issue becomes, whether it will, become an issue that will elect people to office. That's still all to be determined. There's a lot to see.
We're talking with Olivia Waxman from Time. As you were researching this article, is there anyone you spoke to who said something that really surprised you about this issue?
I was really struck by historians regularly pointing out that, you know, the idea of one U.S. history is not sort of what we should be talking about here. It's not that there's one history that should be taught. History itself is just being revised all the time to accommodate for new information, and that's a great thing. It means that, you know, the work to tell a most accurate history of America is alive and well. And I think that's a great point to think about, just being open to hearing all perspectives about what's happened in history, even if it's about history we haven't learned before.
Olivia Waxman, staff writer at Time, read her article about critical race theory at time.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Some passionate debate today in a House committee over guaranteeing paid family leave for all workers. It's something that President Biden has included in his proposal for what he calls human infrastructure, $225 billion to help cover wages for those who are getting a new child, suffering from an illness, or facing other emergencies requiring some time off. At the House Oversight and Reform Committee, here is the chair, Democrat Carolyn Maloney, and the ranking Republican, James Comer.
What we're talking about is balanced policies that I will say that most countries in the world already have, even third world countries. We're the greatest country in the world. Can't we respect our workers? And I would like to respond to my colleagues on the other side of the aisle. that are always very protective of the private sector, and I am too. They're very important. They pay all the taxes for this country. But the private sector is far ahead of the public sector in how they treat their employees. They have in-building daycare centers. They have a birthing. They have milking centers. They have support. They have paid leave. They have, working from your home leave. They have all of these things that the federal government does not have. And let me tell you, when I had my first child and went to personnel to talk about leave, they said, leave? We just want you to leave. I said, I don't want to leave. They said, you will be the first person in the history of this establishment that has had a baby and come back. I said, I am coming back. They said, well, you can apply for disability. I said, having a child is not a disability. It is a joy. It is a family value. It is something we should celebrate, not punish women for. We should celebrate them, give them the support that they so justly deserve in our society. We talk about family values. Where are they? My whole life, I have fought for balance between work and family because I suffered it in my own family. Only recently are people seriously talking about it. When President Biden announced it, I felt like I'd died and gone to heaven, that all of these issues that I had cared about, work-family balance, were being talked about seriously by the President of the United States. It is our job to try to implement them, and that is what we are doing today. And if you do a study comparing the private sector to the public sector, the private sector is doing a much better job in adjusting and really doing work-family balance within their companies. Most of them have paid leave. Most of them have on-campus daycare. Most of them have all kinds of services for their employees, and the federal government needs to keep pace. We know that we can't pay the same salary as the private sector. We know that. We have to find people that are committed to public service, but we also have to help them balance their families with the work that they have. I now recognize that...
Madam Chair, with all due respect...
You're claiming my time.
No, Madam Chair, you went way over your time. You went way over your time. No, Madam Chair, what the Democrats don't understand are private sector employees, too. And employers can't get people to come to work because...
Regular order.
...pay them not to work. You don't understand. There is a disconnect. You are living in...
Someone put the chair in order, please.
You don't know
where the chair restore order.
The taxpayers are sick and tired of giving more benefits and more perks to federal employees because they have to pay for those benefits and perks.
Madam Chairwoman.
You want to raise their taxes even more.
Part of today's House Oversight and Reform Committee, Congressman James Comer, ranking Republican. And you also heard from Carolyn Maloney, Democrat, who chairs the committee. You can find the entire hearing at our video library at cspan.org. Supporters of mandatory paid family leave point out the U.S. is the only developed country that doesn't have it. And a Labor Department survey last year finds 21% of working Americans have access to paid family leave through their employers. This week on C-SPAN Radio's The Weekly Podcast, the battle over the AUMF, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force. Congress passed it in 2002 after the 9/11 terror attacks, and it was used as the rationalization and the authorization for invading Iraq. How is it still used today, and what roles do the three branches of the federal government play in its continued authority, not only in Iraq, but in other parts of the world? One of our guests on the podcast is John Glazer, Director of Foreign Studies at the Cato Institute.
Well, that's an acronym that stands for Authorization for the Use of Military Force. It's a sort of resolution piece of legislation that Congress can pass to authorize the president to use force abroad. Typically, historically, you know, the Constitution gives Congress the power to declare war, and the president gets to execute the military mission that they give permission for. But these days, they make a little less effort, and instead they offer resolutions like these ones that tend to be overly broad in their definition and tend to give the president kind of an open blank check for presidential war making without real borders or limits inherent in the execution of that. So it's a kind of modern feature of the way Congress has allowed its war powers to be usurped.
John Glazer with the Cato Institute will also speak with Elizabeth Saunders, professor in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, both on this week's episode of C-SPAN Radio's The Weekly Podcast, available Friday. Find it and follow wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for joining us on Washington Today, also available as a podcast. And if you haven't, download the free C-SPAN Radio app to listen not only to C-SPAN Radio, but also the three C-SPAN TV networks. I hope you have a very good evening.